It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azhatalin? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
Oh, that looks like a podcast. All right. Welcome, William, to our lovely home.
Yeah, producer, it's good to see you. Your goatee looks amazing.
Yeah, yours as well.
Well, thank you, but I mean, what are we doing here? I mean...
So, I don't know if you know about this, but this is a podcast. It's called The Magical Talking Hat.
Yeah. Well, I know that happens sometimes when I come over here, but usually what happens is I come over here for some other reason, and then when I get here, Tony says, "Those guys over there have done it again, and we have to do a podcast." And I, you know, say, "Oh, great," and we sit down and we do the podcast, but he's not here.
Right, so... That's what I was going to ask you about. What did you do to him?
What did I do to him? Wait. Okay, first things first. Are the guys over there are not doing the podcast?
No.
So Tony and I have to do it.
Apparently. I mean...
But where is he?
I don't know. That's why I asked what you did to him.
I didn't do anything. But he's not here. But you're the producer, so you're here, obviously.
Yeah. And Ezzy's here.
So. And I'm here, but I'm always here when it's that, you know, I just come over here, and then he tells me when I get here that we have to do it. So this is what I'm thinking.
Okay.
He knows before you or I know that it has to happen. But he didn't tell me, because he never tells me until I get here.
Okay, wait.
So he snuck off, is what I'm thinking.
I'm still confused about the whole him knowing something before either of us knows it, because that just doesn't seem plausible.
Well, I mean, he knows it before I walk in the door, so he knows before me. Maybe he doesn't know before you. When do you usually find out that we have to do a podcast?
I just assume we're always podcasting.
Oh. That's probably a good thing to do. But I think somehow he knows, like, absolutely when it has to happen, and so he just snuck off.
Okay, but why would he sneak off? I thought he liked podcasting.
Oh no, we both hate it.
Oh,
that's
true. Sorry.
We don't like
who I was married.
Yeah,
to.
Yeah, we don't like those guys. We don't like having to do it. But I didn't know we could just sneak off. Like I wouldn't even have to have come.
Right. Well,
but he didn't tell me. He just snuck off by himself. That jerk.
Well, yeah.
Well, what am I supposed to do now?
I think we draw questions out of that.
Oh, you're gonna help me with the podcast?
Well, I don't know about help. I mean, I'm here. Might as well do something.
All right, that's fine. Well, okay, so he usually does this bit. What's he do?
He says, "Hello, my name's Tony."
Yeah, but he's not. You're not. Your name's not Tony. Your name's Trish.
Well, so, but I told people earlier at work that I was Melissa, so.
What? Why did you do that?
Because we were... So we had this training, and it's, like, corporate-wide, so there's people from different groups, and so we're doing introductions.
Sure.
The table that I'm sitting at, the first woman says, "My name's Melissa," and then she explains what her job is and, you know, whatever else we're doing for intros.
Sure.
And the next woman says, "My name's Melissa," and the instructor's like, "Oh, that's too confusing," and she...
So let's call us all Melissa.
And so then it's my turn, and so I said, "My name's Melissa," but she knows me, so she... Yeah, but, yeah.
That's
so,
confusing.
I mean, I can be, I don't want to be Tony, though. So, anyway, okay. Hello, I'm the producer.
That's right. And I'm William, and we don't know what episode this is.
Yeah.
But this is the Magical Talking Hat podcast, as the other.
The only podcast in the alternate universe fueled on the tears of toddlers.
Yes. Because, well, first of all, they're cheap.
Right.
There are other sources, but nothing quite as cheap as the
tears of
toddlers. And
they're also a source of renewable energy.
Yep.
And if nothing else, we at The Hat believe strongly in energy conservation.
Mm-hmm. As long as it's cheap.
Yeah.
Green and cheap. That's our motto.
Yeah. Which, I mean, you know, usually those two augment each other.
Yeah.
you're using less energy, you're paying less, so it's all good.
Usually. I mean, that's the idea anyway. But let's see, he also says something about, the way this works is...
Oh, yeah, he always says, if you've never listened before, because I always think those poor bastards.
Yeah, yeah. We've got a hat. Okay, so there's this hat, and it's... What's magical about it is, well, it's got its own email address, for one. And, like, if you write the email address with little brief questions or comments, little thing, not a whole book of stuff, just, like, a one-line question or a two- or three-line comment. If you write into the hat's email address, all on its own, magically, it transforms those questions into these little note cards that we find in the hat. We pull out, and we can read them and talk about them on the podcast. That's what's so magical about this hat. Well, it's not really our hat. The hat belongs to these guys in another universe. We're their evil counterparts. We don't care about the hat. We don't care about any of this stuff, except for some reason... When the good guys in the good universe can't do the podcast, we end up doing it somehow. Now, for me, personally, the way I come into this is, I'm just coming over to Tony's house, and he says, oh, those guys have messed up again, so we have to do the podcast. And that's just what happens. And he's always here when that happens, but he's not here now. The producer's here. We have a producer just like they do. Her name's Trish, and she's married to Tony, just like in their universe, except Cotease. And, but he's not here. And it makes me mad, because that means that, you know, you probably too. We probably all could have just skipped out on this thing. If he can, we probably can.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, I think we certainly have better things to do.
Yeah,
than,
but I thought we had to do it. I mean, he pretty much convinced me that this was a gig we had to do, or like, I don't know what I thought would happen. We'd spontaneously combust or something.
Our two universes would collide.
Yeah. But no, he just decides he doesn't want to do it, and he leaves, and then we're stuck with it. But now, of course, my first thought is, as I'm sure yours is also, well, let's just shut this thing down and forget it. But now I'm afraid that something will happen.
Well, I mean, you're here.
Well, so. I am here, but also, what if he just knows that I'm too scared to not do it? Because I'm kind of a bigger chicken than he is when it comes to stuff like that.
Interdimensionality,
yeah, like
explosions.
Yeah, like he knows.
I mean,
he,
I think you should be fairly cautious about
right,
that.
Right, but he
thing.
Knows. He knows he can walk away from it because I won't, because I'm too scared.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
See what I mean? He's like that with people that he knows he can sort of take advantage of because he's evil.
Yes.
And I'm evil, but I just have that penny thing. So I just get pushed around.
So speaking of evil magical artifacts, has the baby shoe been discussed?
The baby shoe?
All right. Did you notice when you came into the house that we have a magical totem outside?
No.
All right. So for the people who've not been to our house, we have a lamp pole close to the street.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
With a light on it.
Sure.
You know, like you do.
Yeah.
And it has a bracket hook thing on mm-hmm. it, like you do.
Mm-hmm.
So, at some point, after we had that big ice storm and things started to thaw, I was down toward the curb, and I saw this baby shoe. It's a Nike. In case anybody's missing a baby shoe, it's a Nike baby shoe. And I think to myself, because there's just one baby shoe, that whoever lost this shoe probably is still in possession of a matching
yeah,
shoe.
Probably. The other shoe is in their hot little hands.
And feels that it is somewhat useless as a single shoe and might like to have this shoe back.
Okay.
And not knowing who said person was or how to communicate with them, I took the shoe and hung it by the shoelaces from the hook on the lamppost.
Because presumably it was like a kid maybe in a stroller, dropped off his foot. They'll be by again.
You would think.
Yeah, perhaps see it there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes perfectly good sense.
So but now the baby shoe has been out there for a while.
Oh.
And the other day, Tony and I were standing outside when one of the neighbors happened past, and we speak with this neighbor sometimes because they have two dogs, and so they'll be walking the dogs and, you know, we talk to them. And so we were talking to him and he asked about the baby shoe.
Oh. Which by now is probably starting to look a little creepy. up there.
Right, right. And so we developed this whole mythos about how we sacrificed a baby to the, you know, to the gods in order to prevent children from stepping on our lawn. And this is the sign unto the children to get the hell off our lawn.
Does it work? Because just today, a couple of kids were walking on in our backyard, just right through it. I just happened to be looking out the kitchen window, and here they came right across our back lawn. And I was thinking, man, should I do that old man thing and say, "Hey, you kids, get off the lawn"? I didn't do it, but I did feel a bit of indignation because what are you doing just walking on our lawn? I don't know these kids. Right. So if there's a way to warn the kids off with baby shoe.
Well, I've been
decor
that I should take baby shoe down, so you could borrow it, certainly. I have not
But only if it works, I'm not going to put up a baby shoe.
I have not personally seen any children on our lawn since the installation of the baby shoe.
Well, maybe if you take it down, so, all the kids will just come rushing towards your lawn.
Yeah, you never know. You never know. So.
Well, we can get our own baby shoes. I'm just saying, whatever works.
Right, and I'm pretty sure, you know, other articles could also work. I wouldn't
other suggest, baby articles?
Yeah, I wouldn't suggest like diapers or anything that could become a problem in some other
like
way.
Like onesies? If I put up a onesie, it'll scare the other kids away?
Well, you might have to be like ripped or something.
I have to be ripped or the
stained
the onesie has to be ripped. The onesie has to be ripped, okay. I suppose if I was ripped that would also be intimidating to young children, but
yeah, so that might be a different kind of.
But I think next time I see those kids, I might have to yell at them. Maybe I don't know.
You damn kids.
I don't know. The thing is, I can't think of what I'd say that I wouldn't just make me immediately start laughing at myself. So,
right.
Which wouldn't be good. I mean, that's not intimidating at all. And the kids are probably already, they'll probably be laughing before I start. So, but I just don't, why do these kids just this walk right across my back lawn? But on the other hand, evil as we are over here, what's the big deal, really? These kids are walking across the yard. So why do I feel indignant about it? I don't understand.
My niece and nephew, my nephew is younger, and he turned 8 on his last birthday.
Okay.
And turning 8 means that you are no longer required to be restrained in a specific seat in the car. You don't have to have a full car seat or a booster seat. I mean, you still have to wear your seatbelt, but, you know. And he was very excited about this, and so... So I generally offer to drive them places now because they think it's like it's a novel thing to ride in my car.
Mm-hmm. Still can't ride in the front though.
If there's a
what do you call it? No. A thing in the front seat. The reason they can't ride in the front seat is because of the airbag.
Right. So yeah, they sit in the back. But so I transported them someplace. I don't know when I was home over the holidays, and I came back here and 2 days later noticed that now when my windows fog up, I have the names of my niece and nephew.
Yes.
And this made rage rise in my heart.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, and I was talking to their mom because I was like, we got yelled at. We were not allowed to do that.
Oh, that's true. When I was a kid, that's like, right.
For the very reason
that you just said, because it stays there. I mean, then when it fogs over later, this stuff is still there.
But like when I can get past my emotional reaction and think about it just, you know, like as a logical, sane adult, I'm like, what exactly is the problem here that elicits that amount of emotion?
Yeah, the same as with the kids walking across the lawn. It's like, is this just something that happens when you go past a certain age? You just start getting angry about this stuff for no good reason? It's just really weird.
I think it's just because I wasn't allowed to do it as a kid. I'm just jealous. That's really what it is.
Here's a question I thought of as you were telling this story. You know, I was a kid before the era of baby seats.
Yes.
So, in fact, I remember my dad had a van as far back as I can remember. He had a van that he transported all of us in. And when I think back to the earliest memories of riding in that van, I was in the front seat standing up. I would stand up in the seat while the van was going forward. I mean, you know, no kind of restraint whatsoever in this van. And if I wanted to run around in the van while Dad was... In fact, that's why he had a van, so I could do that. And they wouldn't have to worry about anything. apparently they didn't worry about me going through the windshield if there was an accident either. But I wonder if it's traumatizing for kids to get strapped into a seat. Do you think kids who spend a good portion of their childhood strapped into a car seat, you think the constraining nature of that is something that has an effect on kids that I wouldn't understand because I didn't endure that particular kind of toddler torture.
That torture?
Yeah.
Just the torture of the front windshield, that's all.
Yes, but as a child you don't understand. All you know is everybody else gets to sit in a seat and with relative freedom, but you get locked into this thing.
Right. Well, and infants especially, they make them now, I mean, you've seen it, right? And you pull the thing out of the base, and so, like, infants can spend, even if they're not in the car, they can spend long periods of time.
Oh, just in that carrier thing.
Strapped in.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, infants might, not so, I mean, because infants like to be swaddled and all that other stuff. But, like, a toddler, that's just got to be something else to, well, time to go somewhere, and the dread you must feel about having to get strapped into this thing and you can't move.
And you're in the back seat, so you can't
really
see your parent or usually outside or anything. And yeah, I
mean,
I don't know. In
this universe, all of this is totally awesome, but I imagine the other universe, it would be considered pretty terrible.
Yeah, because I'm roughly of an age with you, I think, and my version of that is we had like an old station wagon that had, the backwards facing seat.
Oh, yeah.
But I remember there was a trip, my mom was taking us out to visit my dad's parents, and for some reason my dad didn't go with us, so it was just her and me and my sister, and we were pretty small. So she laid the back out flat and put, like, blankets and pillows and stuff in there, and we rode from Illinois to Virginia bouncing around in the back of a Caprice Classic, and nobody thought anything of it.
I don't know how many times, we'd be playing outside in the summertime, and mom would say, "Hey, everybody, get to the truck," which meant getting in the back of a pickup truck.
Oh, yeah.
And two of us would sit on, there were these, in the bed of a pickup, there's usually like a hump over where the wheel is. Two of us would sit on each of those. Someone else would sit on a spare tire that was sitting up against the cab. We did that all the time, just riding into town. I was talking to my dad just the other day, and he was talking about how when he was a kid, farming with his dad, he used to, when they had to ride in a tractor from one side of the field to the other, he would just stand on the hitch behind the tractor, and they'd be going really fast. But that's just how they did it. Nobody would think of doing that now because it's unsafe, and it is unsafe.
It's obviously dangerous.
Yeah. And accidents happen on farms all the time. I mean, if you're from an agricultural state, then you understand that's it's pretty terrible. Accidents happen on farms. And back then it happened too. Now people are, I guess, a little more safety conscious than they used to be, but I just remember things that we used to do that now, I mean, when my wife's kids were younger, I would never have just thrown them in the back of a pickup truck. Not just because of what other people would think. That would be bad enough, but I wouldn't.
But because you yourself would.
Yeah, I would be like, oh my gosh, I don't want to, if I get in an accident, I just wouldn't, I would never do that.
Whereas my experience, so we would do that, but only when we were out at the farm, because that was where everybody that had a pickup truck that we knew lived. But yeah, the first question when they say get in the truck was always, are we going fast? Because if the answer was no, then you sit on the edge.
Right,
you can see better.
And you can also...
But if they say yes, then you sit on the bed so you don't fall out.
That's true.
And that was our safety mechanism there.
Also,
was the question,
also,
are we going fast?
If you're going slow enough, you can open the...
The
tailgate and sit on that while you're driving, which is just great fun because you hit a bump and you fly all over the place. And you laugh because somehow death doesn't seem like a real option. I don't know
way too young to die.
But I mean, my mom loved us. She didn't want us to die. She didn't want to see our little broken bodies all over the side of the road if she had some kind of accident. For whatever reason, it just didn't occur to her.
How many kids are in your family, though?
Five.
Yeah.
So
we couldn't all fit
in the front,
There's a theory that says part of the whole helicopter parent phenomena is because of decreasing family size.
Well,
and so if you have five children in your case or four in mine, not that it wouldn't be a terrible tragedy and that you wouldn't be greatly bereaved, but losing one of them would not be the same impact as it is if you only have one or two.
That's probably true. There's also, I mean, we were born, 68, 69, 70, 72, 74. All real close together. And you can see that the stress is put on my mom by looking at, they got us all these, they called them baby books. And they're just, they're books that as parents you record
all the
stuff that your baby's first steps
word,
and words.
First
food. And it goes all through they're 5 years old. And my brother, Scott, who's the oldest and I'm the second, both of our books, I know every gift I got for every birthday up until I was 5 years old and who gave it to me.
Right.
Completely. But the third kid and the fourth kid, not so much.
Not so much
stuff recorded in there because, two kids is one thing, but three, four boys that are really close together in age, that was just too much. Now, then the last kid is the only girl. And so then suddenly there's a lot more written in that book because, it's a girl.
Right.
But you could see that mom was getting a little overwhelmed there. But, I don't know. Just, I look back and I'm kind of amazed that out of five kids, so many of us are still alive.
Right. And when I brought up...
you'd think somebody would have died.
At some point, or at least lost a limb.
Yeah, I mean, we rode motorcycles around, and I mean, we another thing we did was we built ramps to jump our bikes off of, and we would jump over things, like, holes in the ground, big holes that if we didn't make the jump, which thank goodness we always did, we would have been very, injured very badly.
Right.
But no major broken bones even, much less, I just can't believe that we... that we made it, but we're all still kicking.
Something we talked about at one point, there were huge swaths of the summer. My mom really had no idea where I was.
Oh, yeah, us too, yeah.
Because I was just basically kicked out of the house with the expectation that when it was supper time, I would come back.
Well, and you can entertain yourself, sure.
Right, and there were certain, so we had a highway that ran through town, and I wasn't allowed to cross the highway because I might die. So there were some constraints on that, but we rode our bikes all over the place. We did all kinds of stupid crap. We hung out in cemeteries mostly.
Well, we often, when we go home down to the farm, we'll be sitting around talking about stuff we did. And I wish I had a nickel for every time Dad says, "Boy, I didn't know that happened." He says that stuff all the time. There's a landfill, a closed landfill, like just behind my dad's property. When you're a little kid, it takes all of, an hour and a half to walk there through all the brambles and stickers and underbrush and all the stuff you stop to look at, like a turtle skeleton and all this stuff. But you finally get to this dump, and it's not a safe place. But we would walk there, and we'd play and stuff, and we were talking about that, and Dad said, "Boy, I did not know you did that. Where was your mom?" he said. "Well, Dad, you were at work, and Mom had five of us, so what do you think happened?"
I'm just surprised you guys didn't haul enough treasure home that he realized it just based on that.
Well, yeah, that's... The thing is, the only thing we ever seemed to pick up was rocks.
Yeah.
And especially if they were shiny ones, we never seemed to pick up... Because the fact of the matter was, our farm had enough garbage around already.
Yeah.
We find garbage at the dump. It's not going to be... It's not any different than home.
It's not any garbage.
No.
Better than the garbage at home.
Yeah, if you knew where I lived and you could go into Google Earth and look down at my house, it's a lot better now around there, but we used to have one of those properties with a lot of old cars around and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, that used to be us.
Well, if it's like it was at my grandparents', you had to pay for garbage pickup, like by the... I don't know, was it by the pound or the cubic foot something? Because they burned almost all of their trash.
No, yeah, we did too. But also, if it's a machine, my family doesn't want to let go of it.
Right.
In fact, one story that's really sad to them humorous and sad is they loaned me a car, and my family's big Oldsmobile family, so a lot of the cars we have out there are Oldsmobiles, and they loaned me an Oldsmobile for me to drive around town in, living here in Coralville. And she wasn't my wife at the time, but I loaned her the car so she could pick up her kids, and on the way home, it caught fire.
Oh my gosh.
She was over on exit 242 in Coralville there, and she just got off the exit, and the thing just burst into flames. So she had to pull over, get the kids out, and they just stood there watching it burn.
All right, then.
And so my family always talks about that because
they didn't get the car back.
Yeah, because every single car that anyone from my dad and my brothers, every single car they've ever owned is somewhere. They know where it is. They might have given it to someone or sold it to someone. Most of those cars were still on the farm, you know, just sort of junked out. And that's the one car that they never got back was that car that burned up.
The one that got away.
The one that got away. That's what they always talk about. It was a burgundy Oldsmobile. It was a nice car.
Until it caught fire.
Until it caught fire. And I don't know what happened, but it burned. It
got hot.
Well, I don't know. It's some electrical thing, I guess. I don't know. Yeah. But anyhow, so I suppose we need to draw things out of the hat.
I believe that's the general theory.
Okay. Well, why don't you go first?
I was going to say, it sounds like a hardship.
You go first. No, you go first because I usually go first, but...
But, you know, the slacker's not here.
What are we going to do when he... We're going to have to... We're going to have to plan some kind of booby trap or some kind of something for when he gets back so that he won't do this again. You'll have to think about that.
Yeah.
I mean, you're the producer, so you're clever and you can figure this stuff out.
All right. I'm disliking this question already.
Oh, we'll see. You're getting into the mood of it.
Into the vibe.
Yeah, this is how this works for us.
Name something pure. This isn't a question, technically, so...
Name something pure.
It's a directive, and it was sent in by Coffee, C-A-W-F-E-E.
Yeah, Coffee.
Coffee?
Something pure.
Well, definitely not Tony.
No. The opposite of Tony is pure. How about that?
I'm trying to think what that even...
It doesn't matter. It's just the opposite of Tony.
Ivory soap is, like, 99.7% pure or something.
Yeah. If, I mean, you know, I suppose.
That's what they say, at least.
Yeah, that's what they say. Something pure. Well, you know, of course, technically, purity can mean a lot of things. The simplest, most basic thing it can mean is when something is 100% of something. Like the, you know, when they say it's 99% pure, they mean that that's really close to 100% of whatever. But like a bar of gold that has nothing in it but gold is pure gold. I have a feeling, though, that that's not what Coffee's after. When she asks questions, she usually has, you know...
You think she has the capability to discover the literal answer
a grander design of something that's pure, not in the strictly physical sense.
So, like, rainbows or baby's laughter or...
Exactly. Stuff like that. Okay. Like, and why you would call that pure.
Do you believe that there's a grand design... that this particular question is being answered by our evil selves rather than our normal selves? Because I feel like that really is probably going to color the response.
That's a good point. Well, you know, I don't know. When you're evil, you have the luxury of, at turns, believing in destiny and not. Do you know what I'm saying? You have... When you're evil, you can totally, at one moment, tell somebody, it's your destiny to do X, Y, or Z, or to obey me, or to, you know, fall and worship me. But then, the next time, you can give this, you know, amazing monologue about how life is meaningless and, you know, darkness and despair is all that is all we have. That's the great thing about being evil. You don't have to commit.
You don't have to be consistent.
No. You can just make stuff up. And that's what the good people, that's their weakness. They can't do that.
right.
If only they could, maybe they'd win once in a while.
All right, so let's do that then. Pure things.
Pure evil.
Oh, pure evil.
What is pure evil? Oh, yeah, Tony. But, I mean...
And possibly Esmeralda.
Yes, possibly. Yeah, I'd say we've got pure evil down pat right there. And you know, that makes me wonder about what I said before about the opposite of Tony. If there is such a thing as pure, whatever that is, I suppose as evil people, we would probably, you know, as a rule, just sort of to keep our reputations, we would say no. I mean, you know, you if you're evil, you can't have people thinking you believe in
right. Everything, purely good. Everything's corrupt.
Yeah.
Because we corrupted it. Because we're evil.
That's right.
Ha ha.
But just speaking, you know, hypothetically.
I had some curry last night that was really good. Maybe it was pure.
Pure? I suppose, and thinking about the other questions Coffee has submitted, because I listen to the podcast. I know. Tony tells me I shouldn't, but I do. I listen to the podcast, so I know what other questions she asks.
All right.
You know, like, they're often sort of philosophical in nature. And I think pure, you know, that term, the way I think that she wants us to think about it, is about an experience, right?
You think?
Yeah, and it's about an experience, a life experience. Like, okay. Like pure joy, or pure bliss, or pure romantic love, or pure, you know what I mean? It's something that you experience that seems to be perfect. Like it couldn't possibly be better. There doesn't seem to be anything tainting it or taking away its high quality.
Yeah, okay, but I think there's two things there. So there's that it is a peak experience, mm-hmm. or a pinnacle.
Sure, yeah.
But then you're also talking about perhaps being in that moment. So I might have a moment in which all I am aware of is joy or anger or, you know, whatever my emotion is. Not necessarily that it's my peak experience of that, but that I am so fully in that moment.
That there's
I'm
nothing
not
else.
Distracted.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I think you can look at it in those two ways. But I think that I think what we're looking for here are those more commonplace, relatively more commonplace things that you're talking about, where it's not so much a peak experience, but it's a focused, you know, a very full, complete experience.
Definitive.
Yeah.
All right.
And it could be even life-changing. You know, something that you're going to remember for the rest of your life because of how, pure it was. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
It doesn't have to be ecstatic, but it might still be a kind of epiphany, in a way, if that makes any sense. I'm trying to think of an example.
I was going
to
say, do you have an example?
I'm trying to think of an example.
I feel like you're working your way around to one, but
well,
I haven't quite gotten
there. Well, there was that one time where there were two times that it happened, and they were actually both the same. One didn't diminish the other by being the second time it happened. When I was shadowing that physician in Kentucky in 1986, and he had me, he got permission from the mothers, but he had me observe two deliveries, okay. And it's sort of a transcendent experience. Seems like I don't think I'd call it a peak experience. I mean, I wouldn't say it was kind of an ecstatic thing, but there was something transcendent about it. And the word pure does seem to come into play because it seemed like in that moment, boy, it's so hard to put into words. If you've never been in the living room while a child is being born, it doesn't have to be your child. I'm so sure if it is your child, it's a whole different thing. But there's just something, I'm not a superstitious person, and I'm not a person that speaks in terms of moments being, magical or miraculous or anything like that. That's never really been my thing. And so those words, even though they sort of present themselves to my consciousness, not only do they not seem to fit me, but they don't even adequately fit the occasion, because it was, those words are way too trite and small. You just feel like you're being witness to something of cosmic significance. It's not supernatural. It's not paranormal. It's not anything foreign like that.
Right.
It's real. You know what I'm saying? That's what it is. It's when you go through life and you experience things in a very subjective way, and you seem to really be aware of that subjectivity, like, or at least I am, and you're constantly questioning whether or not you're crazy about the way you see things and the way you're responding to things. You know, like the kids walking across the lawn and feeling indignant and wondering, what the heck's that about? But all of that ambiguity that you experience in other times in life was gone.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? It's like, no, this is exactly what this is. You know, there's something universal about everything that's happening here. And not just about a woman having a child, of course that's universal, but all of the feelings that all of us here are having about it. We are all experiencing this. We're standing in different places, but we're still experiencing the same thing. You know, there was just this feeling of I don't know. That's the best I can describe it. It's something of cosmic significance, not in a religious way or anything. It's just in a very concrete, like this was a moment of realness.
Reality.
Yeah, this was real. This wasn't just in my head, right? This happened. And I think part of it is because for this person that just was born, you know, they're going to celebrate their birthday every year. You know, this is a moment that they're going to not remember, obviously, but they're going to mark, and everyone they know is going to mark this event in their life. And I was there. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
It really sort of blows your mind. It really takes you out of yourself, I guess. And that's what I meant by transcendent. And I suppose if someone asked me, you know, to describe an experience that I would be worthy of the term pure, that's probably one of the experiences I would pick, is that, because it seemed to be completely devoid of anything artificial or selfish, or, you know, any of the qualities of human life that we tend to not like, or we tend to think of as not so good, or that diminishes the quality of life. All of that stuff is gone, and nothing is left except this, you know, perfect moment that of such amazing significance that makes, you know, all the other things that you do in your life kind of pale a little bit in comparison. But and then the second time I saw a delivery, it was exactly the same. It wasn't any different. It was, you know, someone might say, okay, well, that was the first time, you know, it was this big miracle of life, and so you're going to be jaded to this now. Nope. And I've heard doctors who deliver babies say the same thing. You know, they've delivered thousands of babies, and
right,
every single time they do it, it's like, wow, you know, it blows their mind, and they just feel so privileged to be a part of this in the mother's life and the child's life, and if the father's there, his life. So, I don't know.
Do you remember Teresa? Did you ever meet Teresa?
Teresa
Lau, I believe, is her last name.
Don't know.
Was kind of on the fringes of our social circle for a while, and I think when we first met her, she was a resident or something. Anyway, she's a doctor now. She's OBGYN.
Oh.
And she and I at one point had a conversation about home birth. And it was funny because we were going, you know, I was fairly pro home birth, and, you know, her as a medical professional, not so much.
Okay.
And we were going around and discussing this, and the funny thing was, the end of the conversation came when she said, when a woman gives birth, she's standing on the line between life and death, and that's why she needs to be at a hospital where medical professionals are present. And I said, exactly, which is why she needs to be at her home with her support. We see this in exactly the same way, except the solution is different.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, aren't there, I mean...
Oh, there's all kinds of mitigating factors.
Well, but statistics, yeah, too, right? Like, you know, midwives and, you know, delivering children in that home setting. I mean, doesn't research show that that's a very, very beneficial way to do it? I mean, granted,
I'm biased, so yes.
Oh, okay. You know. Now, granted, but, if something goes wrong, then yeah, they're far away from the hospital, and that's not a good thing. But but that,
and that's where you get into some of the mitigating. You know, myself living within how many miles of two hospitals, it's a different decision than you know, someone that doesn't have that kind of access.
Right.
But anyway, sorry, I got distracted by that. You talking about this? So when Marcia and Kirk had their first child, I was at the hospital dropping off something. I don't know. Anyway, I was there not when Jace was born, but when Marcia was in labor. And it is like a very hard thing to try and describe to somebody, because the word that I always, that always comes to my mind is awesome, which sounds like, but I'm like, no, in the sense of invoking
awe. Yeah.
Know, like, not like in that it was great or really cool or anything. Because I don't know. There's all kinds of things in life that you can't control, but that is such a, like, profound, you know, here's arguably my best friend. She's struggling. She's in pain. Mm. She's uncomfortable. And, like, and there's nothing really to be done about that, but to just go through this process.
But also, she's not sick. You know, it's just not an illness. I mean, we're not talking about... You can say a lot of the same things about a person who's about to die, but that's the exact opposite is about to happen. And it's, I don't know. I think you could just write volumes about this, and a person could read the whole thing and still not get it if they've never been there, which I usually, for most experiences, I think is a total cop-out, because the one thing I love about humanity is how good they are at sharing experiences, like really good.
Right.
Human beings, I mean, a human being can tell a story that really transports the other person there, whether it's in writing or verbally. And a lot of people, I think it's too bad how sometimes that ability of human beings is sort of downplayed by people wanting to insist that, well, this is, you'd never understand this because you've never been a parent. You've never been, you know, this or that or the other thing. And there, of course, there's a certain extent to which that's naturally, obviously true, but I think sometimes it's taken to an extreme where it really shortchanges human ability both to tell a story, but also to empathize and understand a story and to put oneself in that position to maybe not understand it perfectly, but understand it well enough that those two people can really connect, and then there can be some, you know, healing and things from that. But this is one of those experiences in my life where it's like, boy, every time I ever talk about it, which isn't very often, I've probably talked about it twice since it happened, and they've probably, you know, both times it's been in this house. I always walk away feeling like, man, I just, I could not figure out how to talk about that experience. But there are very few human experiences like it. You know, I mean, people talk about religious experiences, but the problem with those is, if any people who have had religious experiences are like me, there's always afterwards questioning what that was, right? Was that just in my head? Was that just wishful thinking? Was that just some chemical reaction that I was having? And now
something I ate.
Yeah, you know? I mean, but with something like this, that's just, you know, yeah. It was what it was, and there just aren't very many experiences like it, and it's pretty amazing. But so I suppose if I sat and tried to think of other things that are pure, I can think of things that I think of as pure, and I think other people do too. Certain types of relationships, certain intimate moments between two people who love each other, or, you know, perhaps a married couple or whatever. You know, those are things that a lot of people like to think of as pure, and it seems like a lot of words are used in books and a lot of film is used up trying to portray that kind of purity. But I think we can all acknowledge that, you know, those types of human relationships are a lot more messy and complicated.
Well, because of the consistency.
Yeah. Then, but of course, for me, that mess and complication is kind of part of what makes that amazing too. But you know, I guess as I'm thinking about it, while I'm talking about it clumsily as usual, I can't think of a more unambiguously pure thing or moment than that moment when a person's being born. I mean, it's just
right.
You just can't get around it.
And the only other thing that I can think of, and it's way easier to talk about. It's, you know, I don't think everyone has this experience, but I don't think it's that uncommon. So I was aware of the precise moment when I lost my immortality. So we talked about this a little bit earlier. You're a kid, like, it just doesn't cross your mind that, you know, something horrific could happen to you. You do stupid crap all the time, you know, you go places you probably shouldn't go, you do things you probably shouldn't do. And I was probably in my early 20s, and we were at the ocean, and it was rough, and I was in the water, and my brother was in the water, and we had gotten more distance between us than I was entirely comfortable with. Mm-hmm. And so I was trying to swim toward him, and I was not making a huge amount of headway, and I was getting really tired really fast. And I thought to myself, well, what's the worst thing that could happen? And
it occurred to you just what that was.
It occurred to me that thousands of people had died in the body of water that I was currently in, and that there was nothing stopping me from being one of
those people. That's right.
And I turned toward the shore, and I got out of the water, and I was done. And my brother's like, what the hell happened to you? And I'm like, no, dude, you don't understand, because he's 5 years younger than me, right? You know, so I'm like, you don't get it. But we don't need to be out there. And my mother, who always, whenever, this is like a ritual in my family that, you know, like, because the Atlantic where we're at is not usually very rough. It's usually pretty placid. Mm. And so when you reach a certain height, it's not that exciting, you know, because the waves are like 4 feet and
sure.
You're six.
Sure.
And so we would wait for the rough days and then go in. And my poor mother is always like standing at the end of the deck, like, you know, the widow's walk, waiting for somebody to come back, because we're too old for her to just flat out tell us, no, you can't do that.
Right.
And too young to realize that we're idiots. So, yeah.
Well,
but that was just a very clear moment.
That's interesting. I think I probably had moments like that too. And I mean, maybe, I don't know if it's probably not something I want to acknowledge, you know, to my conscious mind, but
It's we'll record it for posterity.
But it's probably true. It's probably true that just as much as a birth is one of those moments, death is too. I mean, I was. And this is, but the thing is about that is there's, it's that ambiguity I was talking about before. I was present when my mom passed away, and, you know, obviously that's the, you know, exact, that's that kind of moment. It's the exact opposite thing. And, ever since then, I've struggled with this, this incredible ambiguity about, you know, part of me is like fully half of me is like, God, I wish I hadn't seen that.
Right.
And the other half of me is, I'm glad that I was there for, you know, whatever, all the kinds of reasons why you want to be there for something like that. You want to be there with somebody when they're going through that significant moment. But, boy, it's like, the two sides just cannot find any kind of common ground.
Solution.
Yeah. It's just, yeah, again, there's no words for it. If I could go back, I'm sure I would do the same thing, but not because of my conviction of its rightness, but just because I wouldn't have known what else to do. And, you know, I've had conversations with my father about that because we were all there. My mom had, she had diabetes and, you know, some years before she'd lost her leg and she was having problems with her, you know, congestive heart problems like a lot of people who have diabetes do. And she was having kidney problems and originally she was admitted to the hospital because of a blood count problem, which often happened. I mean, this had happened to her several times since she lost her leg, and we thought it was just going to be another routine thing like that. They'd have her in, they'd watch her, they'd let her out. But she, while they were treating her, she died. I mean, you know, like while we weren't around, and they had to resuscitate her.
Okay.
But then she wasn't breathing on her own. Okay. So she had a tube for a while, and that went on for several days, but mom, you know, had that living will kind of thing going on where, you know, it's like, you know, don't keep me on a machine kind of deal.
Right.
So we all had to get together and talk about, you know, whether or not we were going to do that. And, which I'm sure anyone listening can imagine how difficult that would be. And so we decided, you know, that's what she wanted. And she wasn't unconscious, so we could even kind of get from her the notion that that's what she wanted. So, you know, we removed the tube and everything, and she seemed fine at first. But then she kind of slipped away. And yeah, it was also one of those kinds of moments where this is the real deal. You know, this is something that everyone in the room is experiencing the same thing at the same time. You know, there's not going to be any ambiguity about this except what I just mentioned about how I feel about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I know how I feel about the delivery. I mean, that's just what it is. But the conflict, but that's the only conflict. I mean, and I think everyone in the room feels that conflict as well. I mean, certainly I've talked to my siblings about it and my father, and they've all described similar feelings. But, yeah, birth and death. I mean, you don't, I guess there are two things you don't really think about just in your day-to-day life, you know?
Right.
Even if you have a pregnant friend and oh, I found out, you know, Sarah had her baby. Oh, great. Still, you don't go through the mental process of the person being in labor,
right,
and all that stuff.
What that entails.
Right. And so it's just, it's this thing that happens that's huge.
Right.
And a person passing away is really the same thing. It's just this enormous thing. It's probably the two enormous things, of course, in a person's life that nothing else is quite that enormous. happens all the time, every second, and it's just, you just don't really think about it until you have to. And then it's, it just makes everything else in your life seem like, like, you know, I don't know what.
Well, and that's what I think we spend a lot of time on things that we tell ourselves are important.
Mm.
You know, I'm lucky enough to have a job where I believe in what my company is trying to do and, you know, stand on some ethical ground there. When we worked together before, we were making the lives of insurance salesmen easier, which was not quite as strong of a ethical calling there. But I remember, this isn't directly childbirth, but it goes back to that. So when the neighbors were having their second child, Tony and I were responsible for the oldest.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one day when we were responsible for her. And it's weird how, like, I mean, you have kids, so you know this, but, like, you babysit sometimes when you're younger, you know, whatever. But there's such a difference when it's like, you can't just, like, you can defer almost any decision when you're babysitting.
Yeah,
be
yeah.
Like, wait till your parents
come. Yeah, the
home,
parents are going to be home, you know, in just a couple hours. That's right.
Maybe tomorrow you can do that. But when you're responsible, like, you don't have that out anymore.
You got to make the decision.
And so I remember there was one morning and, you know, I'm getting ready for work. Tony was not working at the time, so he's going to stay home with the kid. And she was really cranky and, you know, we're trying to figure out what's going on. Anyway, figure out that she's running a slight fever, which is not any big deal. She's probably teething, and it's typical for her to run a slight fever when she's teething. And I even know that, you know, usually we just give her baby Motrin, and I know where the baby Motrin is, so I go and I get it, and I give it to her. And my logical adult brain is confident that I have correctly diagnosed and solved this problem.
Yep.
And so I go to work. And I'm at work, and people are talking about things that they feel are very important. Deeply important. How we're going to test children, you know. And I'm just sitting there wondering what the hell they're talking about and why they're talking about it, until the afternoon when I finally I'm in a room with my boss and a couple of my peers, all of whom have children.
Mm-hmm.
And so I finally just stopped them. I'm like, I don't understand how you do this. and they knew that I was watching the neighbor kid. I was like, I have a kid at home with a fever. And they're like, oh, well, I'm like, no, she's teething. I know why she has a fever. I gave her the Motrin. That's not the problem. I have a kid at home. Why do people think I'm going to care about anything other than that? I don't understand. And they're just like laughing at me. They're like, you just learn to deal with it. And I'm like, because some things are unarguably important.
Mm-hmm.
Being born, dying, you know, children being in danger. Those things are important.
Yep.
Whether we meet our third quarter goals. I mean, yeah, we tell ourselves that's important and we're, you know, really gung ho about it, but it's just not the same thing.
Well, and I can tell you, it barely helps to remember that, well, yeah, the whole reason I'm at this job is so I can make money, so I can feed this kid. I mean, you know.
And buy him the baby.
Yeah, that does come into it a little bit, but mostly you just kind of wish that you could just pay complete attention to this situation till it's done and then maybe go on and think about things that aren't so important. But the thing is, when it's with kids, it never ends.
Right.
And that's probably how you get used to it is
you just become numb.
Well, it doesn't stop, right? It's like when the fever's done, there's going to be something else, and then something else, and then something else. And then, of course, when there's no problem, you want to enjoy the good things, you know, playing a game or whatever. So you just, there's only two options here. Either you're with this kid 24 hours a day, which you have this incredible urge to do, but can't because then they will die of starvation. Or you find some way to, you know, shut that off while you're at work so you can get the job done and get back to what you really want to be doing. But yeah, that's the way it works. But it looks like we're getting close to being out of time.
Yeah, I was going to say. So we're like right at 59 minutes. So we probably either should do another question really quick or...
No, we should wrap it up. Because he always says stuff like... Let's see. He says stuff like us on Facebook.
Like us on Facebook.
And go to...
Don't send us crappy political memes, jerks.
Yeah, don't do that, whatever that means. And also don't... Do
follow us on Twitter.
Twitter, and also what's that other thing? Oh, go to themagicaltalkinghat.com and leave comments in the blog. He says all that stuff.
Follow us on Instagram. What's that?
Are we on Instagram?
Snapchat? No, we're not on Instagram. There's some other thing that the kids do now. I don't even know what it is.
We don't care about
Yelp,
the kids.
Yelp, Pinterest, whatever.
Tinder.
LinkedIn.
Swipe. Which way are you supposed to swipe if you like us?
I
don't remember. It doesn't matter.
Hot or not, we're totally on there.
Kids, just do what kids do.
Right.
Kids be doing.
Kids don't listen to podcasts. They're like, what, I gotta download shit? Whatever.
Yeah.
All right. Do that, whatever it is that Tony wants you to do, do that stuff.
Yeah. Where's the off button?
Oh, yeah, I'm supposed to push the button.
Yeah, there's a button over there that I think you have to push.
All right, well, I'll probably screw that up again, too. All right, Hatters. Whatever.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.